Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now be conducting a question-and-answer session. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star one on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the question queue. You may press star two if you'd like to remove your question from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. One moment, please, while we poll for questions.
Okay. And while folks are thinking about their questions, for those of you who may have been madly scribbling down notes, fear not. Everything I covered is on the slides that will be posted on the IOMSN Town Hall website. So if you miss something, don't worry. You can get it later on the website.
Yeah, Brent, you covered a lot of material and really great material. While we're waiting for questions, I just want to ask you, what are, if you could drill down in your personal practice, what are kind of the screening tools that you think are essential for screening for depression in a clinical practice for MS?
Sure. Thank you, Jen. That's an important question. My guess is that might be similar to questions other folks may have. Thinking of a battery that is both freely available in the public domain, so it's not going to cost your practice anything, and also can be very effective, I'd recommend a combination of a depression screening instrument, a fatigue screening instrument, a cognition screening instrument, and a pain screening instrument. For depression, the Center for Epidemiologic Studies Depression Scale is freely available, and it's been validated in MS. That's a good one. The Beck Depression Inventory, if it's available to you, is also been validated. That's very helpful. But for some places, you actually have to purchase it to use it, so there could be a financial cost there. But either of those is good for depression. For cognition, the Multiple Sclerosis Neuropsychological Questionnaire is a good place to start. For clinicians who are trained to use it, the Symbol Digit Modality Test is a 90-second objective measure for working memory processing speed. That's a very good screening and cognitive assessment tool. For fatigue, the Multiple Sclerosis Fatigue Impact Scale, which is part of the MS Quality of Life Inventory, is a very good scale. The Fatigue Severity Scale is another one that's good for MS fatigue. And the Pain Effect Scale, which is from the MS Quality of Life Inventory, is a nice 5-item pain assessment scale for MS. By using each of those together in a battery of 4 instruments, you can really start to triangulate in to get a basic snapshot of what's going on. Each of those instruments is less than a page long, and to do all 4 of them, I'd say you'd need maybe 5 or 10 minutes.
Great. That's really very, very helpful and useful information for clinical practice. So, well, I know some of that is in your PowerPoint presentation, and we can kind of also drill that down and put that on the website as well for folks who want to go back to that. It's a great clinical, kind of tip. I think we have one question in queue, so Manny, can we go ahead and take that question?
Yes, our question comes from the line of Patricia Pagnotta from Orlando. Please go ahead.
Brent, that was a absolutely wonderful presentation. Thank you so much, and such a like you said, highly prevalent problem in MS. But I wanted to ask, I know probably in your area you have neuropsychologists readily available to you, but what we find difficult in our area sometimes is getting the approval for mental health care. So oftentimes I'll send persons off, because we do have a neuropsychologist, to our neuropsychologist, and that will be covered under their medical benefits, where it's very hard for us to get people in with mental health sometimes. So when you have that difficulty, how do you decide if your drug is not working? How do you try to get them into a psychiatrist? Because the neuropsychologist will work with us and really define the difference between cognitive problems and depression, and they'll do some counseling with them under their medical benefits. But then when you need a drug and the initial ones you put on were not really effective, how do you work with that?
You brought up a critical challenge. I bet that many of us, it'd be interesting to learn what our geographic distribution is for all the people who are online with us today. But I would bet that 9 out of 10 of us are probably dealing with that issue. If you have folks that you can refer out to, sometimes either insurance won't cover or there's a long delay up to months in order to get people in on wait lists. And you can get testing done by a neuropsychologist, but they can't prescribe, and they usually don't do cognitive therapies. There's a few options. The first is to improve clinicians' ability in the general MS clinics to treat depression, to start first and second line treatments. One caveat on that is that, or one option would be to embed a mental health practitioner within your MS practice. That's the model that I've been using at Dartmouth that's been very helpful, especially if that person is cross-trained in MS. They can often help to both treat the mental and the physical symptoms at the same time. And oftentimes patients with MS will report, gee, I've got a great neurologist and a great general MS nurse practitioner and a great counselor, but the counselor doesn't know anything about MS and the MS practitioner doesn't know anything about my depression. So tightening that linkage can be helpful, but sometimes that resource is not available. The third option is to work closely with the patient's primary care practitioner to have them prescribe the medications. I think that gets towards the access issue of your question, but the other question is, how do you assess it? For antidepressant therapy, we would expect at least a 25% reduction in symptoms within the first 4 to 6 weeks of pharmacotherapy. And one way to assess that is to use something like the CESD or the BDI repeatedly as patients come in. So if you get a baseline score of, say, 26 on the CESD, and then 2 months later you've got a score still at 24, and your clinical assessment seems unchanged, you've got two pieces of information there suggesting the treatment was not effective. On the other hand, if your CESD drops by 50% at week 6 and your clinical assessment agrees, you have some sense that the medication treatment is effective. For counseling therapy, it can take longer, but you should see some initial effect within 2 months at the very least.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Trish. Manny, is there any other questions in queue?
Not at this time. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, please press *1 to ask a question.
Brian, I was going to ask you, are they doing any type of electroshock therapy in kind of in the MS realm at all?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm not aware of any MS-specific studies. However, that being said, it's probably good to bring up the point that ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, is actually more effective than any drug treatment for depression. And it's actually much safer and much more tolerable than it's ever been in the past. In the past, you know, we have these thoughts of people being electrocuted on a table in some medieval type of setup. You know, the current electroconvulsive therapy procedures are very brief. They're done under partial sedation. Patients hardly even feel them, and they can be very, very effective. They're usually used as third-line options after other things haven't worked. The downside to ECT is that mild short-term memory loss can be a side effect of ECT, and for patients who already have baseline cognitive impairment due to multiple sclerosis, this may be something that's undesirable for obvious reasons. So it's certainly something to be considered carefully, but that being said, if the patient is not responding to any other therapies, it's certainly something to consider.
And then my other question I had too, just what is your opinion kind of on some of the batteries that are available, things like NeuroTracks, things that, you know, I've used in different clinical situations, but I'm curious, what's your opinion, as far as in practical use, or do you think it's best just to go ahead and use the validated clinical tools that are specific to MS?
I think both are likely to be helpful, and depending on your clinical environment, using something like NeuroTracks may be preferable to using some of the validated tools. The instruments like NeuroTracks and others are very good at determining a what I would call a gross signal or a basic indication that something may be wrong or not. They may not be as helpful in determining how much of what's wrong is present, but I still do think that they are helpful in terms of being another method of assessing whether there are cognitive issues going on in a patient. The validated instruments try and get at that from another angle. And certainly we don't want to substitute either of those for clinical assessment. But having one or both of those things in addition to clinical assessment can certainly give you multiple perspectives when you're assessing for cognitive and depression status.
Great.
So I certainly wouldn't say that one is necessarily better than the other. I suppose if I was pressed on it, I would say go with the validated instruments whenever possible because they've got more research behind them. But something like NeuroTracks is certainly okay.
Good, thank you. I just wanted to ask the audience members if they had any clinical questions. You know, anyone want to share any of their personal experience, maybe to run a clinical situation that you might be having some challenges with, to Dr. Oliver, if you'd like some advice. Do you have any experiences that you want to share, Brant, just to kind of elaborate on some of your research interests?
Oh, sure. I guess what I would say is that in many cases, standard therapies are likely to be effective. And this can, I think that's a very important message for all of us to hear, because sometimes we think, you know, especially with psychiatric issues, that you know, only a mental health practitioner can handle this or only a mental health practitioner can treat this. We're finding that the majority of patients fail treatment because either they are never started on a treatment or there's improper follow-up. So that's not really telling us that it's a matter of specialized expertise or needing a mental health specialist in each case. It's more a case of doing basic assessment consistently and starting people on treatment consistently when we diagnose depression, and then having good follow-up, which in depression is at least within the first 4 weeks of starting a antidepressant medication, and then monthly thereafter for the first 3 months, and then at least Q3 months after that. Oftentimes what we find is that patients will be started on antidepressant, but it's never titrated up because there's no follow-up visit within the first 2 weeks of the first month after starting antidepressant therapy. So I would say that if there's one take-home message, I would say from a general perspective, is that there's a ton you can do, even if you're not a mental health specialist, to assess depression and then start people on first-line therapy. But just remember that only 30% of people who meet criteria for treatment for depression are currently getting it. So certainly if a patient is depressed, definitely having extra attention to that knowledge that only 3 out of 10 of those people are getting treatment, and making extra sure that they get started on treatment. And then once they're on treatment, that they have appropriate follow-up.
Yeah, that's surprising that only 30% are actually treated, and that's probably just because we're not asking the appropriate questions, do you think?
Certainly, especially in a fast-paced practice. The purpose of the visit may not be a mental health assessment. It may be, you know, just a general MS recheck, and we're concerned about the MRI scan and how's the immunotherapy going and have there been any relapses. All those things are very important. What I would add is that, you know, just one question about depression in that quick follow-up visit, and perhaps the use of a standardized instrument in the waiting room that the clinician could check during a general follow-up visit.
Many, are there any questions in queue?
Yes, our next question is from a line of Dorothea Fohl from Philadelphia. Please go ahead.
Hi, Dorothea.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for a wonderful program. Jan and Brant, you did not disappoint me. I've been looking forward to this since it was posted. My question is that even when I have patients who have money or good insurance coverage, I don't always have the mental health resources available. And I'm in a city. I'm not in a remote area. But finding the right person can be a real problem. So I was really taken by your comment about cross-training. And I'm wondering, are there any models for cross-training or programs that you particularly recommend? Or even just self-study ways that we could build the resources we have for people who are familiar with both MS and the mental health field?
Now, that's a wonderful question, and currently there is not, but I certainly have a lot of interest in helping to develop something like that. And I'd be curious to see if other IOMSN members would be interested in helping with that. I think developing something like that would be very helpful.
I do, too.
There certainly are programs for primary care providers that have been developed
mm-hmm.
have been very helpful, and we may be able to modify some of those.
Yeah, Daddy, you bring up a great point, because it would be nice to have something similar to like the Multiple Sclerosis Certified Nursing Board, or the one that we have for the specialist, something like
mm-hmm.
that also for mental health would be
a self-study, or even the model we have for our regional programs mm-hmm. where we get such a tremendous response from the community.
Absolutely, and I'll put in a plug for the nursing profession here, because there may be a unique opportunity for nurse practitioners here. Many nurse practitioner programs now allow students to dual certify in family psych, like I did. And
mm-hmm.
what it allows you to have is both general and psychiatric specialty knowledge. And nurse practitioners are often much more affordable than psychiatrists to employ and can be embedded within MS practices. It may be a model that could work for some places.
And my experience is that the nurse practitioners or advanced practice can be wonderful teachers for the rest of us as well.
Absolutely. You know, in the ideal world, it would be great that, you know, if we had some of these dual-trained nurse practitioners in practices, that they would also be precepting NP students
exactly.
in the practice.
Okay, I sense a fellowship opportunity here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm in.
For our spare time.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
my
Daddy,
pleasure.
For
thanks.
Calling in. Manny, do we have any additional questions in queue?
Yes, the next question is from the line of Jennifer Boyd from Toronto. Please go ahead.
Hello, welcome.
Thanks, Brent, for a great presentation. My question relates more to anticipatory guidance. In light of the high prevalence of depression in MS, what guidance do you give to patients and their family members as well on how to recognize depressive symptoms so that they can get assessment and treatment in a more timely manner?
Wonderful question. I start by appropriately framing it as one of many common MS symptoms to immediately try and destigmatize it and to include it as something that is common in MS, just like spasticity might be, or ambulatory ataxia or urinary symptoms. It's one of a common checklist of things to check for. In terms of self-assessment, I try to drive home those two category A criteria, whether there is prolonged sadness or anhedonia, and getting them to understand that, whether they're finding a decrease in interest in things that used to be fun to them. If they're noticing either of those things, or especially if they're noticing some suicidal thoughts or feelings, those are immediate red flags for them to call in. I also try to orient them to the Sigi CAPS mnemonic, things like sleep disturbance or change in energy level, change in concentration, things that we care about anyways from a general MS perspective, even if it's not depression. If any of those indicators are changing, it can be helpful for them to contact us. I don't know if that gets at your question completely.
That was great. Thank you very much.
Sure.
For calling in, Jennifer.
I'd like to once again remind everyone to please press star 1 to ask a question. And we do have one more question in queue. It comes from Lori Mayer in Austin. Please go ahead.
Hey, Lori, go ahead.
Oh, hi, Brad. It was an excellent presentation. Really enjoyed it. There were so many, I mean, you hit so many topics, and I guess there's a couple things that just kind of punched out with me. One thing we had talked about, you had mentioned the neural tracts, and actually we have used that, and we found that it just, and I think you had mentioned it, it just was not specific enough.
Yeah.
It was fairly general, which was fine, but we pretty much had already assessed that the patient had some cognitive difficulties, I think, and we just felt that it wasn't, obviously, not as specific as your neuropsych testing that you would go through. But one thing, that there's a couple things that you brought up that I thought were really great ideas for us as nurses to share with the patients, and one was talking about one fun activity per day.
Yep.
And just an excellent positive reinforcement for that. Could you expand a little bit more on that?
Sure. Reinforcement kind of works like, if you can imagine, you know, you go to work and you work and then you get your paycheck, and the paycheck is the reward that motivates you to, among other things, hopefully we're getting enjoyment out of the work we're performing as well, but both the enjoyment and the pay we get are reinforcers, or they reinforce and motivate our behavior in the future. Well, it turns out that depression can be reinforced either positively or negatively in the same way. So, for example, if I'm depressed and I just sit around and don't exercise at all and don't do anything fun, and I just think that I'm not really a great person and my life's not going well, that will reinforce me to remain depressed. On the other hand, if I disrupt that pattern a little bit by introducing, you know, 10 minutes of exercise a few times a day, or one fun activity for 15 minutes, it could be reading a book, it could be taking a walk, it could be doing a hobby, even if that activity isn't perceived as being that fun by the patient at the time. It could have been something they enjoyed in the past, but due to their anhedonia, it doesn't feel fun anymore. But even if they do one of those things for just 15 minutes a day for 3 to 5 days a week, you can get as much as 35% reduction in initial depressive symptoms within 2 weeks. And that positive activity actually negatively reinforces the depression. It's a very powerful behavioral approach and very simple.
And that's without any pharmaceutical interventions, correct?
Yeah, no copayment required.
So when you're discussing this with patients, do you basically talk about it exactly the way that you just explained it to them? You know, in order for them to understand that this is part of your prescription that you're giving them to follow this guideline to try?
Yeah, and I'll use visual aids. I'll, you know, take a whiteboard and I'll, you know, just draw it out a little bit. Some patients are more visual learners than auditory learners. But I'll use that work and paycheck analogy to explain the reinforcement idea and to give them a sense that this could actually be something real if they have depression, to help them reduce the depression, but also as a preventative measure. You know, certainly if the patient doesn't have depression, it'd be great to recommend that they do something fun once a day. Even if they don't, it'll probably help to improve their quality of life. And it can have a preventative effect against depression.
Well, and actually, it would be good for me, too. I think it'd be good for all of us to remember, you know, we work so hard, sometimes we forget we need to have that time, too, as nurses.
Well, sometimes I'll do it alongside with the patient. I'll challenge them. I'll say, okay, you know, we're both going to try and do 4 fun activities for the next 2 weeks. And sometimes I found that I've been behind on eating. I'm like, well, how did you do? I did 2 out of 4, and the patient beat me, you know. So sometimes that can help to engage and destigmatize it for the patient, too.
Well, and that's just a great analogy to work with, too. I think they can give them the work and the paycheck, just a really good visual for them to do it. Thank you. That was really a great idea.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks, Lori, for your question. Well, kind of to expound on that a little bit, Brant, if you have, I imagine there may be some challenges with that if somebody is highly unmotivated because they're already depressed.
Mm-hmm.
At what point are you engaging family members to try to be supportive in motivating the patient to do these fun activities and to kind of do the reinforcement behavior?
Whenever possible. You know, in many cases, there can be a problem with that because the patient is already isolating and not having much social contact. So sometimes the positive activity is sometimes just making a family contact once or twice a week by a phone call or by just visiting with them for half an hour. In other cases, you may want to avoid that when the family itself is the source of the stigma. And in that case, you may want to engage a peer support group first as opposed to the family. But in many cases, family members are very eager to help. The challenge there is to make sure they don't get over-eager and start hounding or scolding the patient if they're not participating. Usually, I try to start off with something small at the individual level and then start to build in the family at the same time as seems appropriate based on the dynamics that are going on between the patient and the family system.
That's great. And the only other thing I wanted to ask you, if you would discuss it with the group, is, you know, a lot of us have started support groups with our centers just because I think that's something very employable that nurses can do. Is there any website or any resources that you've come across in your experience with working with support groups that you would recommend for those of us who are maybe starting groups or considering starting support groups?
Oh, sure. Obviously, the National MS Society website is a great place to start. The CanDo MS Center has a number of wonderful approaches that are certainly worth checking out. Certainly, IOMSN and CMSC have a lot of resources that can be checked into as well. And depending on where you are, if there are larger MS centers in your area, even if you're not don't happen to be working within one, there may be local programs available to you that you can access, even if your patients aren't going to that academic center. There's one other resource that some places are utilizing, and that's actually a peer mentoring type of support. Where instead of a support group approach, there's actually a one-on-one or a two-to-one type of situation where MS patients are helping each other. So it's almost as if an experienced MS patient is paired up with a new MS patient or someone who is experiencing depression for the first time. Sometimes that can be very helpful in providing more of a one-on-one support, almost like the idea of a sponsor in AA, although certainly they wouldn't be going through a similar program like that, but something along that idea with it. They had somebody who would be available to call and who would know them well.
Yeah, and I think that's actually probably quite helpful. I mean, I know a lot of the pharmaceutical industry has employed that kind of peer-to-peer program. But I do think, you know, kind of in the community when it's employed, we're also the person who's helping kind of mentor the mentee is also getting a positive reinforcement in the sense that they're feeling fulfilled that they're helping someone.
Absolutely. And that's a very good point that I don't think I explained very clearly. Sometimes getting the person who is depressed, this is usually later on in therapy, but to get them to act as a mentor to someone else can be very reinforcing and help to reduce and depression symptoms and also prevent depression relapses.
Great. Manny, I just wanted to open up the lines if there's any additional questions in queue.
Yes, we have a question from line of Elise Herlihy with from Los Angeles. Please go ahead.
Hello, welcome.
Thank you very much. I had just had a question regarding treatment with ECT that you mentioned for people who are really treatment resistant with medication. The mild short-term memory loss that you mentioned that could be a side effect of ECT, is that something that persists or does that resolve?
It's about a 50-50 split. So about half the time it will resolve, and sometimes it can be permanent. So it's certainly something to consider carefully before doing.
Okay. All righty.
But on the other hand, by the time folks are considering ECT, they've failed a number of treatments, and especially if they're feeling very suicidal, they've had suicide attempts, and the depression is of a dramatic magnitude, the risks of ECT are often outweighed by the benefits.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All righty. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you.
Great question. Manny, do we have any additional questions in queue?
Not at this time.
And I think I'm going to give Brant you the last opportunity before I close if you want to summarize anything before we close the program.
First of all, I'd just like to say thank you for a really great discussion. I was really impressed by the questions tonight, and I think we, as usual in these sessions, we often bring up some new ideas as well during the discussion, so thank you everyone for your time and attention. I guess my bottom line would be is that you do not have to be a psychiatric specialist to treat depression and MS, especially in the first line. Remember that only 30% of people with depression and MS are receiving care. So putting more emphasis on assessment, which questionnaires we talked about can help with, making assessment part of the general MS evaluation for follow-ups and initial visits, and making sure people get started on first-line therapy soon after assessment and then have appropriate follow-up afterwards. If you do those things consistently, you can make a big dent in depression and MS. And also to remember that depression is the primary cause of suicide. Suicide rate in MS is much higher than the general population, and depression is treatable. So by really paying attention to it and being cognizant of it, even if you're not a mental health specialist, you can do a lot to reduce the burden of depression in multiple sclerosis.
All right. Well, on behalf of the IOMSN Town Hall Discussions, I would like to sincerely thank Dr. Brant Oliver for your presentation and all of your great resources. And thank you again to Novartis for supporting these programs through their unrestricted educational grant. I'd like to remind you, of course, that all of Dr. Oliver's presentation is available on the website. It is archived as well as a podcast. So please go to www.iomsn.org to access those resources. And additionally, I just want to remind you to please join us next month on Wednesday evening, August 15th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for the next town hall discussion entitled Pediatric MS Nursing, which will be presented by Jennifer Boyd. Additionally, there will be a post-town hall discussion survey that will be sent out to you by Lenny Almeida. We ask that you go ahead and complete that and send that back to us. It does help us to revamp our programming as we see fit and as is requested. So we, again, thank you so much for joining us this evening. And again, thank you so much, Brant, for all of your information, your knowledge, and your contributions to MS Nursing.
Oh, my pleasure. It's an honor to be here, and thanks, everyone, for your time and attention.
So we bid you good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes tonight's teleconference. You may disconnect your lines at this time. Thank you for your participation.